This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. As the incidents string together, no amount of insisting that African-American victims are innocent young men with their lives ahead of them, no amount of insisting that dead police officers are brave heroes and leaders in their community can prevent this nation from crossing a line. The line is out there somewhere, and we're getting close to the moment when a conflict becomes a war and the numbers become a casualty count, indicating that this is a desensitized conflict we almost endure if we can't actually come up with a way to fight it. Listen to these sounds of the shootings that killed three police officers in Baton Rouge yesterday morning.
Shot fired, officer down! Shot fired, officer down!
An absolutely unspeakable, heinous attack on law enforcement here in Baton Rouge.
This is supposed to be a Benny's car wash, still shooting.
It's unspeakable that these men, risking their lives to protect and serve this community.
Everyone right now focus on words and actions that can unite this country rather than divide it further.
Consider your own reaction to those sounds, and consider a home-style radicalization with alarming implications considering how many veterans there are in America. The gunman, now identified as Gavin Long, a Marine sergeant, killed by police, state, and local officials after shooting and killing three officers in Baton Rouge. Long's prey was those police officers, Colonel Michael Edmondson, superintendent of the Louisiana State Police, said today. He drew them to the scene. Long had been carrying an AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle. For the latest from Baton Rouge, we turn to Maya Lau. She's a reporter for The Advocate. Maya, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Hi, thank you.
What are people saying about the details that are being learned about the alleged shooter here?
The shooter here is Gavin Long from Missouri. He's a former Marine. He had deployed to Iraq, and he appears to have a social media profile showing some extremist language, some, you know, heated language about recent police shootings, including the one involving Alton Sterling.
And how tense is the community based on, you know, this, again, happening so close to the Alton Sterling shooting and then the Dallas incidents? I mean, this does appear to be escalating.
Yes. I think the community is feeling, especially like since he's not from here, that he doesn't represent us. He's not part of this community. This is not an expression of our community. So that plays a big role. Many institutions, buildings around town, including the Advocate, lit up the building in blue light last night in solidarity with law enforcement. So I think that there's a feeling of we had just had a few days of calming down after some intense protests. And it was a total shock to have this horrifying news on Sunday morning that three officers had been shot and killed.
As a matter of security, though, if individuals from around the country who have been trained in the military and have access to presumably pretty high-powered weapons are going to extend and continue revenge killings based on, you know, incidents that they have nothing to do with, what kind of a security threat is that for a city like Baton Rouge?
I guess that's the ongoing conversation about the prevalence of guns in our country. You know, people have different thoughts on that. Interestingly, the sheriff yesterday made mention of that several times. He said that he did not think that this was about gun control, that this had to do with what's in men's hearts, is what he said. So, sure, I mean, I think that anywhere where you have a lot of guns, that's potentially an issue.
Is there any voice that you've heard in the wake of all of this that has stood out to you as either a unifier or representing the sense of anger and fear in the community?
You know, one person I'm thinking about is Representative Ted James. He's organized some of the protests, but they were peaceful marches, you know, very serious and solemn. But also, he's gotten on the bullhorn at some of the more rowdy protests and urged people to go home, to channel their energies toward a peaceful protest. So there's been a lot of voices like that. He's not the only one that have really stood up and said that they're angry and that after Alton Sterling's killing, that something needs to be done, but that it needs to be done in a productive way.
Maya Lau is a reporter for The Advocate in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
A lively conversation on Facebook about the Baton Rouge shooting. Maureen Hickey Oladwe condemns the violence of terrorists. We assume it to be a foreign problem, yet we seem to be solving our problems in the same violent, vigilante way. We need Gandhi right now. Mike Perot. Well, more than 1,140 people killed by American police in 2015, according to The Guardian and the Department of Justice records. Surely not all of those are unjustified, but with the frequency of clearly unnecessary killings, I think it should give all Americans pause. And now, is there any clarity right now in the tense situation in Turkey as the week begins? An unsuccessful coup in which 265 people died has become a huge backlash against the rule of law in Turkey. The president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is an Islamist who mobilized his support on the street to put down the coup that we all watched in real time over the weekend, then sacked thousands of people in the military and the police force, and finally targeted the judicial branch. Hours after the coup, 2,745 judges were removed by the Turkish government, setting the stage for a possible dismantling of the constitution. And the whole matter has become a wedge in U.S.-Turkish relations, as Erdogan has accused 75-year-old Fethullah Gulen, an Islamic cleric living in exile in Pennsylvania, of directing the failed coup, and has demanded that he be extradited back to Turkey. Kim Lane Shepley is a professor of international affairs at Princeton University, specializing in Turkey.
Well, Mr. Erdogan has been making Mr. Gulen the villain of his regime ever since they had a break. So it's not surprising that he's actually going to accuse Mr. Gulen of having fomented the coup. The problem is, of course, that no one can actually tell based on any evidence that's public now. So, you know, this puts the U.S. in a very difficult situation because the U.S. needs Turkey in NATO. It needs Turkey in particular because the U.S. is using a Turkish airbase to launch its airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. And so if Mr. Erdogan is going to make cooperation with the U.S. contingent on extraditing Mr. Gulen, this puts the U.S. in a very difficult spot.
Which may be exactly what Mr. Erdogan wants, regardless of this particular incident. Is there a pattern, as you can tell, in the sackings that are taking place, the people who are being either arrested or dismissed from government service?
Yes. Well, one of the things that you see is after the coup was neutralized, immediately the government moved to fire almost 3,000 judges. It's 2,745 judges and prosecutors. Now, you don't actually come up with a list that's that long within minutes after a coup is over. So they must have had a list of judges and prosecutors, also a list of military people. They're going very systematically through the people that they thought were connected already to Mr. Gulen. So they had a story even before the coup started about where their threats were coming from. And now their purges are actually acting out that scenario. So one of the difficulties is that none of us can really tell without knowing what they know, whether this threat was actually the one that materialized or whether the threat came from somewhere else. But what you see now is that Mr. Erdogan is engaged in a massive purge of the military and of the judiciary, which were the two institutions most likely to stand up to him. So against a broader background, this really also can look very much like an attempt to create a kind of plebiscitary dictatorship in Turkey.
Why target the judiciary after a coup? That wouldn't seem like one of the top suspects.
Right, exactly. And there seems to be no evidence that the judiciary was actually out on the streets or in the tanks or anything of that kind. But the judiciary traditionally in Turkey has upheld the Turkish constitution. And the Turkish constitution is relentlessly secularist. In fact, one of the reasons why Mr. Erdogan's party has had the kind of trajectory it's had is that all of the prior Islamist parties before his were dissolved by actions of the constitutional court. So the judiciary is very much pledged to a vision of Turkey that Mr. Erdogan doesn't share. And so it would not be surprising, and in fact, over the long time that he's been in power, he's been trying repeatedly to remake the judiciary in his image. And I'm afraid the coup gives him the chance to now finalize that takeover.
What seems to be the top priority of President Erdogan? Is it consolidating power around him as a dictator, or is it some ideological opposition to secularism and modernism in Turkey?
Well, it's a two-faced campaign. So one thing I think that's most dominant in his mind is that he really believes that he is the savior of modern Turkey. And he thinks of himself as someone who can restore the role of religion to public life. So there is a kind of ideological component. But it's very hard to know how much that ideological component really drives him, or whether that's the thing that actually mobilizes the masses to come out onto the streets to defend him. He's shown a pretty relentless drive toward eliminating all other sources of power in the state. And so that's the thing that many of us are worried about when we watch the way he's engaged in these purges after the coup, because obviously they're working from lists they had before the coup. No one can sit down and make up a list of 2,745 judges just off the top of their head. So this is obviously playing into a broader plan they have for consolidation of power, I think.
Kim Lane Shepley is a professor of international affairs at Princeton University. Thanks so much, Kim.
Thank you.
The 2016 one-of-a-kind GOP convention in Cleveland is a power struggle. It's an attempt at a coronation for Donald Trump. It's a week of damage control. But will it go down in history as a battle for the identity of the Republican Party? The Republican governor of Arkansas, Asa Hutchinson, believes the Cleveland convention is a moment for unity. He admits having had serious doubts about candidate Donald Trump, but says the unifying force of the GOP right now is contempt for Hillary Clinton. Asa Hutchinson should know about Clinton contempt. He was a prosecutor in the Bill Clinton impeachment trial. He's a graduate of Bob Jones University and has no political identity crisis of his own. He says he's a Reagan conservative through and through.
I see on the Republican side an increasing level of unity. I know I'm probably the minority opinion on that, but I think people are starting to recognize that we've got a nominee. It's Donald Trump. He's picked a good vice presidential running mate. And whenever you look at the alternatives, we better unite, get behind him, and make a difference in November.
Is there an identity crisis in the GOP right now? And if so, why?
Well, sure, because you've got someone who's leading the ticket who's not a traditional conservative in the way that we all grew up in the Republican Party and Ronald Reagan conservatism. He comes from a different approach. There's a Ronald Reagan streak in him, particularly in his populism and his way he communicates with the average American. But he comes at it from a different angle. And so, you know, this is getting used to time. And also recognizing, as I have, that, you know, he's going to be a chairman of the board, a president, that's going to build a team that's going to accomplish the mission of our country, and it's going to be built upon what I believe is our Republican platform and principles. And so people are getting used to that, reconciling it in their own mind, and particularly when you contrast to the other side, people are saying this is a very important election and it's not a time to sit on the sidelines.
Is there anything that Donald Trump said to you that caused you to say, you know, he's on my team? Or did you just come to that because it's kind of the only option at this point?
No, I did meet with him in New York, had a very good meeting. I recognized in that meeting that, you know, his style is not going to change. His style is not, you know, my cup of tea. But I like him personally. I think he presents himself in a personal fashion, you know, in a way that gives you confidence that he can build a team. He's got that experience in business. Whenever you look at his family, that is such a credit to him and are so active in the campaign, that gives you a level of confidence. So, you know, a personal meeting did help in terms of my level of confidence. But then also, it's just simply a recognition of the people around him are going to be who's running the administration, who's going to be under his leadership and overall direction, going to be shaping the direction of American policy, and that gives me comfort and excitement about the potential.
The people that are angry out there who have really been responsible for Donald Trump's success in the primary season are typically white, have economic problems that really stem directly from 2008, and the expectations of their children are not the expectations that they had or that their parents had. Is this a moment of shift in the United States? And what's your message to those angry people that Donald Trump seems to have found, but no other party has gone after until now?
Well, it changes the dynamics for the fall. I mean, we have a chance to win in states that we haven't had that opportunity before. It's because of Donald Trump's message of going after the blue-collar worker, the factory worker who sees the wages being eroded or losing the job.
So you see Ohio in play.
I see Ohio in play, Indiana in play, Pennsylvania in play. Already the polls demonstrate that, Michigan. So I see that as a strength, and I don't see him losing the South. You know, that should be a strong area of states for him. You do, though, have to also guard, and I want to protect here the Republican Party and the direction we go over the long term, and that is we don't want to forget about Hispanics. We don't want to forget about the diversity of the American population, and that the Republican Party has to have an outreach to them as well. And that is something that we have got to help shape and do better on the fall, and I hope Donald Trump will help on that.
Finally, it's not about forgetting the Hispanics the way Donald Trump has run this campaign, or forgetting people of color like African Americans. Some of that he's just saying, to hell with you. I'll win without you. I don't care about you. And certainly the accusations that come from Democrats and others about Donald Trump is that he's deliberately alienating those people who had thought they were a part of the United States. And the leaders of the Republican Party are concerned that that is just the last thing that the GOP needs to be doing in 2016.
I will do everything that I can between now and November to, first of all, make sure that minorities, those of color and diversity, understand that we're an open party, that we want their participation whenever they can support the ideals of our party in terms of a limited government and freedom and strong defense. That's the message that I want to convey. It's also what I want to help shape the policies of the potential future president and Donald Trump. So we're all a part of that team. We've got to make sure that we convey the right message, and that will be my message, is that we are an open party. We want to make sure that we have a broad base.
Can you deliver Arkansas for the candidate?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Governor Hutchinson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Asa Hutchinson, the Republican governor of Arkansas. We spoke to him at the 2016 National Governors Conference in Des Moines, Iowa, on his way to the Cleveland Convention. It's easy to feel divided these days on the big issues. If we want to unify America, we have to compromise. What's an issue you'd be willing to bend on in the name of progress? Nogales, Arizona, I'd bend on anything to get a serious pro-life law through.
My name is Luis Rodriguez from Charlotte, North Carolina. And I'm black. I bend every day. My life depends on it. I smile when I want to scream. I laugh when I want to cry. I don't want to bend anymore. I want to stand.
8778-MY-TAKE. Tell us a story like that. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. It's day one of the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. We'll talk to a confident mayor about how prepared his city is for divided delegates and protesters all over his city. Delegates are right in the middle of conflict. Do they vote principle with the likelihood that their candidate will be soundly defeated, or join the party? Donald Trump may have won over 13 million votes in the Republican primaries, but for many delegates inside the Quicken Loans arena, Trump's success over the last year is seen as a hostile takeover of the entire GOP. Takeaway's Todd Zwillick is in Cleveland all this week. He got these thoughts from first-time Republican delegate Sandra Ziegler from Texas.
There are a lot of conservatives in this party who believe that Donald Trump is a failed candidate. You know, I understand that we're all here to have, you know, a coronation, but we believe he is a failed candidate. He's not our nominee yet. We have been working to do everything we could to pick a different nominee for our party because we think that we're headed for disaster. You know, when you have a candidate on the other side that 52% of the people thinks should have been indicted on criminal charges, and yet people prefer her to Donald Trump, we've got a problem. It's time to pick somebody else. And so this is not an effort to help Hillary. To the contrary, this is an effort to get a candidate that could actually be successful against her in the fall. And I think we could unify around several different candidates in our party. It's just not going to be Donald Trump. Donald Trump has done almost nothing to try to unify this party. In fact, every chance he's gotten, he's really sort of snubbed his nose at conservatives. He's spent more time wooing Bernie Sanders supporters than he has conservatives.
You sound like You sound like you feel used.
You know, I feel like Donald Trump is basically asking conservatives to be eye candy in his entourage. He's not offering us a meaningful relationship, okay? So even with the selection of Governor Pence as his VP, which, by the way, I don't think ever would have happened without this pressure that the conservatives brought and this effort to free the delegates. And, of course, we heard that he was trying to even bail on that, maybe at the last minute pick somebody else when he thought that pressure was off. You're right. I don't think that he has any respect for the principles that we hold dear and that we're trying to protect.
What's in the cards here, at least to get some attention? What are you willing to do on the floor of the convention, Sandra, to bring some more light on this?
Well, I don't want to let the cat out of the bag, but I do think it's very important for the leaders of our party to understand that the grassroots that is the energy of this party that keeps it going is not happy with the set of rules that was passed out by that committee that disenfranchised us and left us without a voice in this process.
Reince Priebus says it's over. He says that the rebellion is over.
Well, it's interesting. Reince Priebus is not the delegates. He's not the delegates to the Republican National Convention in 2016. He's the head of the RNC, and he can say what he wants to, but the delegates have a voice, and we're going to use that voice.
You're talking about something that could have a downside, which is to show the television cameras and everybody out there watching that the Republican Party is not unified and is limping into the general election against the Hillary Clinton juggernaut here.
You know what's interesting about that, though? Our party's leadership seems to be so deathly afraid of that, but I really think the public is tired of plastic. I think they're tired of fake. They know that our party's not unified around Donald Trump. That's no secret. So stop treating everybody like children is what I would say to the RNC, and let us do our job. Let us have an actual vote, and we'll all live past this week.
Sandra Ziegler is a delegate from Texas. She spoke to The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick in Cleveland. Donald Trump may be presiding over the convention, but the streets of Cleveland, the streets of this longtime Democrat city and solidly Union town, are presided over by the mayor of Cleveland, Frank Jackson. GOP revelers, Black Lives Matter protesters, pro-Trump protesters, and generally anyone, he says, with a message is here.
Cleveland is the focal point for all of that right now. Everything's going to come together in Cleveland.
Mayor Jackson has been in charge since 2006. He's led the city through the dark days of the recession that hit the former manufacturing town and through the Tamir Rice shooting and protests of 2014. The city right now is basking in the reflected glory of the NBA Cleveland Cavaliers and the first sports championship in the city since 1964. The mayor insists there is plenty of glory to go around, and he's confident as the convention gets going.
We've pretty much managed the recession and financial crisis associated with that. As a matter of fact, we were able to do some investments in those very difficult times that helped us create infrastructure that made us competitive and help us win selection of the convention here. So, there has been transition. Throughout it all, Clevelanders are, working class, blue collar kind of community with tenacity, and we've weathered that storm, and now here we are today putting on a convention.
Some say that the delegates in the hall are one audience, but the real audience for this convention is those blue collar workers that you're talking about, those potential Democrat crossovers that might actually be attracted to a Trump candidacy. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't know about Trump in particular. That's to be determined. But I do believe that probably was a factor as the Republicans looked at the state of Ohio as being a swing state and looked at that portion of Ohio that was heavily Democratic that helped President Obama win twice and all other Democrats win the state of Ohio. So I think the location in choosing Cleveland, it had to be in their mind.
Do you think that it's possible for Ohio to do another sort of Reagan switcheroo, which is what happened in 1980 when the crossover blue-collar unionized conservative Democrats went over to the Republican side and Jimmy Carter lost in 1980?
Well, I don't claim to be one of those talking heads that can predict those kind of things. I will say this, however, that we live in a very different time, and we live in a very challenging time where people are looking for answers. And so the traditional ways of doing things are not as settling with people as they may have been in the past. So anything is possible. I am actually more focused on how we're putting on a convention and our preparation and how we intend to put on a successful convention in terms of the Republicans being able to do what they do successfully, but also safe and secure convention for the delegates, for their families, their friends, for the police, for demonstrators, protesters, visitors, and so that we can actually, when this is over with, be an example as to how things should be done, and particularly in these very challenging times.
Would you say that the police are being tested at this event?
Oh, all the police are being tested every day now. It's just the times we live in. They're being tested every day. The intensity and the concentration of attention for this event, of course, people will be watching. And that's what we actually look forward to in some to some respect, in not running from those challenges, but really engaging them and engaging them in a way that we believe is appropriate as we move through the times that we live in.
Mayor Jackson, thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Frank Jackson is the mayor of Cleveland, Ohio. Sometimes it's difficult to restrain the host of this program from showing off.
When John Henry was a little baby, sitting on his daddy's knee, he picked up a hammer and a little piece of steel, said this hammer's gonna be the death of me, Lord, Lord. That's all you need.
That was me playing the old folk song John Henry on the mandolin and croaking out the lyric and making the argument perhaps that the mandolin should stay in the case most of the time. But hey, check this out. Now this is showing off, and it's for a good reason. It's completely awesome.
Oh, Lord, see it's all there. Oh, Lord. Oh, Lord. When John Henry was sitting on his daddy's knee, he picked up a hammer and a little piece of steel. Said this hammer gonna be the death of me, Lord. Hammer will be the death of me.
Musician and composer Jacob Collier took my riff and turned it into an instrument in his band, a band that could include anyone. Collier's instrument is his voice, but he also plays keyboards and has worked for years to create new ways for people to play music and to be in an ensemble. From his room full of instruments, he takes short video clips from fans and turns them into electro-synthesizer choir pieces using software developed when he was at the MIT Media Lab. Collier's first album is a celebration of all this, and it's called, appropriately enough, In My Room, a room in London which has become a recognizable music venue. The extreme geek version, you might say, of the Royal Albert Hall.
It's funny, I didn't really set out to build this sort of empire out of this one room. It's a sort of paradise for me. It's a place which seems to have reached lots of people in many different ways. I think that the idea of having one's own space where one can create is a very exciting proposition.
And people send little musical notes to you, and I mean like post-it notes.
Well, I woke up feeling good, I woke up feeling good. I woke up feeling good.
And then you send back your response to them, and then they to you. You fully harmonized. Right. Yeah.
Well, I woke up feeling good. I woke up feeling good.
When I'm in that room in the studio at home, I record every single voice. And that can be many different voices singing one note. So it might be a harmony of six different notes, but then each of those voices is sung by two or three different notes. So, you know, 20, 30, 40 voices.
There's just something about those complex harmonies, because there's something about a person singing a cappella that can feel a little lonely. Yeah. Boy, that goes away.
Oh, that's fantastic that you say that. I think that, I mean, the voice is one of the hugest instruments on the planet, and you can do so many things with it. And I'm such a huge harmony fan. I'm a harmony freak. And it's one of these things that if you kind of understand how much potential it has to, in some ways, just kind of affirm something. You know, it's like putting something in a kind and exciting and forgiving context. Then that is something that's quite nice to do for oneself and also for other people.
Lots of musicians have described, you know, tracks that they will, you know, send back and forth, albums that get constructed in various places all over the world. But here, it's both the tangibility of a band and the global reach of the internet.
I have been blown away by just the sheer number of locations from which I've been able to source these melodies. I mean, people have sent them from all over the place, and everyone ends up in that room, which is my sort of place of work. And it's a treat to just see the internet doing what it does best, which is essentially just bringing people together.
Did you ever sing in a choir?
I did some singing in choirs when I was a boy, and it was funny because I began as the highest voice in the choir and obviously ended as the lowest voice in the choir. And so I understood how it felt to sing in each of those positions. Hmm. I think now it's the joy of, you know, I know how the alto feels when it's leaning on that suspension, or I know how the bass feels when it's supporting, or how it feels to sing the melody. And each of those positions is something that I can now explore on my own and, you know, take that love of being that part in the harmony, you know, forward. It's really awesome.
What's the list of everything you could possibly do if it was Collier all out?
That's quite hard to quantify. Yeah. I mean, in some ways, my main instrument is just that room. It's existing in the room. I mean, that's kind of what the album is all about. It's a room full of so many small, tiny, intricate little instruments, including many normal instruments like the double bass or the piano or the drums. But, you know, I'm a bit of a stickler for sound, and I'll go into the kitchen and find, you know, the right-sized saucepan and give it a knock, and it'll go, boop, you know, and that's a sound that I'd use, or just tearing the house to pieces.
Your parents are just fine with all this.
Yeah, no, I mean, they are unbelievably forgiving. But it's a world where sound is more important than instruments for me.
Do you know the work of Bobby McFerrin?
Oh, I absolutely do. His kind of vocal acrobatics are unlike anybody I've ever heard. You know, the nice thing about Bobby is that he doesn't sing with all of this range just for the sake of singing with all of this range. He sings it as a true musician, and that's what comes first. Mm-hmm. That's really refreshing. I think it's very important.
Yeah, and that's exactly the way you are. You choose your accompaniment based on the sort of inner spirit of the original text or the original vocal.
I've tried to do that, yeah.
These videos come across as performances, even though they're not.
Mm.
They're all about the solitary room, but they feel like a stage, not a room.
Mm.
How's that going to complicate your live performance if you're going to go that direction?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, I had to essentially find a way to take that room on tour, it being my main instrument. A friend of mine, Ben Bloomberg, who is a grad student at MIT, he reached out to me about building some equipment where some instruments have been built from scratch to enable me to run around and do different things. But then there are ways of looping things. There are ways of visualizing everything on a screen. So what it is essentially is a kind of multimedia experience, which is what I've been investing in at home. But it's a whole different world when you put that world in front of a whole bunch of other people and share it without needing to necessarily go to all these places and be with all these people.
With everything you've done and with the various ways you've been able to explore music and forming a band online and creating songs and composing in all sorts of different ways, what's releasing an album even mean?
In some ways, it's the most special thing that I've ever done. They are amongst the first songs that I've ever written, but they are informed by this kind of universe that I've crafted of, you know, working in this room in my family home. I'm using all of the different instruments in that room, all of the knowledge that I've acquired from exploring in that room for all of my 21 years, and I've sort of crystallized that world of living there and experiencing music there.
Jacob Collier, thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
It's been great.
Cheers.
Jacob Collier is a singer, arranger, composer, and multi-instrumentalist. His album, In My Room, is out now. To check out the video Jacob made harmonizing to my tune, visit thetakeaway.org.